House Democrats are moving forward with impeachment as new troubling details emerge of efforts by Trump and Barr to push foreign governments to help them investigate the origins of the Mueller investigation. What will happen with the impeachment inquiry going forward? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name's Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a CNN legal analyst. I'm ordinarily joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, but she's on the campaign trail, so we are going to be bringing in Asha Rangappa, your favorite guest, according to our recent listener survey. Asha is a former FBI agent. She's a professor at Yale University, and she's a CNN legal and national security analyst. And frankly, she is a person that I turn to often to, you know, talk through and discuss these issues. So this time, instead of it being me and Asha on the phone, it's going to be me and Asha here on the podcast with all of you. Welcome back, Asha. Thanks for coming and joining me again.
Thanks for having me, Renato.
I will tell you, the news just breaks so fast. Just in the last 24 hours, Mike Pompeo admitted that he was on the call with President Trump talking to the Ukrainian president. We had this sort of faux session with the state OIG who came to Capitol Hill for an urgent meeting, and it turned out to not be very urgent. We've had what I guess I'll call a shift show today, where the New York Times published a story, suggesting that the whistleblower had reached out to the House Intelligence Committee first and was told to go through the official channels, and much is being made of that on the right. And then, of course, we also have, and we're going to focus on the impeachment inquiry, but it's worth noting that also what happened today, we have the Southern District of New York and Justice Department seeking to intervene in the personal suit that Trump has brought against a state prosecutor. This, I think, is the Manhattan DA that is investigating Trump's financial dealings, his tax, specifically his tax returns. So a lot going on. And I have to say, a lot of the questions from people, Asha, are, you know, trying to figure out what's going to happen next and what this all means. So I'm curious what your reaction is to some of the recent events of the last day or two.
It's really hard to parse through, Renato. I mean, it's like drinking out of a fire hose, you know. I mean, listen, I think, and you and I had a offline conversation yesterday, I think that despite all of the noise, the fact remains, like, what you can never erase is this phone call between the president and the president of Ukraine, where he was essentially leveraging his presidential authority over funds in order to secure a personal campaign benefit. And so a lot of all of this other stuff feels like noise, or it only kind of adds to the gravity of that particular event. And I think that that's kind of how people need to approach this, is to not, you know, keep your eyes on the prize, is what I would say.
Yeah, I agree with that. As you know, I wrote a column in Politico,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other day, and that was essentially my argument, is that, you know, one piece of advice, I literally last week when I was trying a case, I was telling my client the same thing privately, that, you know, separate and apart from this, with the case that we had, that, you know, the number one insight I have from trying cases is that it's important to be telling the simple story and to force the other side to tell the complicated story. And so, you know, if I'm the Democrats here, what I would be doing is focusing on this Ukraine story. It's so simple. Everyone understands it. You can explain it in about 15 seconds. And it's really, there's no defense to it. And so let the Republicans try to distract with all this other stuff and complicated stuff and just stay focused on that story and focus on getting to the bottom of that story and just let everything else kind of fade into the background. And I think, you know, there I will say that, that column generated a lot of criticism. There's a lot of people who feel like, well, that somehow sanctions Trump's other conduct, or that the having more evidence out there is going to convince the other side more. And I don't see that at all. And I will say, you know, I think what we saw today, Asha, really was the Republicans now finally latching onto something. I mean, you could really see the sort of the right-wing machine in gear today.
Very quickly
pushing the Schiff line
of
attack.
The Schiff show.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think, you know, my understanding, Renato, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that focusing on the Ukraine piece, even if it's for a single article of impeachment or a few that are based on that and maybe obstruction of that particular inquiry, doesn't preclude other articles from being added later or, you know, I mean, in other words, I don't think it's an either or. This seems to me to be an analog to a criminal investigation / indictment, where you can kind of have superseding indictments. You know, it's not necessarily that if you focus on this, you're excusing the other behavior or necessarily taking it off the table for all perpetuity.
Well, that's completely right. And one thing I will say, though, is that, you know, there's a lot of political folks who said you get one shot at impeachment, and if you fail, the public is not going to look kindly on you trying again. And I think that, I mean, that's a fair point, but I would say that, you know, you have to take the shot that you have with the best evidence that you have. I don't really think throwing in all this Mueller stuff is going to convince any of the people on the Republican side of anything. They've known about all of that conduct for quite some time and have written it off. And so, you know, that was never about that, you know, bringing those counts on that was never about convincing, in my mind, convincing Republican senators, but about, you know, Democrats feeling that they had to do the right thing. And here's a chance to do the right thing on something that's, you know, a better selling point to the public. And more importantly, I think an offense that is so obviously wrongful and easy to explain that I think it would resonate more with the public. And it's also something that I think, because the most important evidence is already out there, it's something that could be wrapped up by the end of the year, which is important, because if this drags on through next year, when we're, you know, the Iowa caucuses are going on and New Hampshire and so forth, you could imagine a lot of Republican senators saying, like, why would we possibly just voting no and being able to use the excuse that we want to let the American people decide in a few months?
Those are all great points. And, you know, one of the things about the Ukraine thing is that it's completely divorced from the Mueller inquiry, at least in terms of, you know, how it came about. And I think the other thing is, you know, let's not underestimate, as we are watching in real time, that, you know, Trump and other people in his orbit will commit more crimes as this gets investigated. And I'm sure you've seen that before, too, whether it's obstruction of, you know, Congress in terms of producing documents. I know that the Department of Justice issued a preservation order to the White House. Mm-hmm. Not to destroy any of those documents. And, of course, if they have already done so, or if they do so in the future, that would constitute in itself a separate act of obstruction, again, divorced from anything related to, say, the Mueller investigation.
That's right. I will say, though, you know, it's an interesting point that you raised a moment ago when you said that, you know, you've probably seen this before, Renato, people committing crimes, you know, while you're investigating them and more crimes piling up. And that is without a doubt the case. And I think another thing that often happened when I was investigating particularly white collar crime is you would investigate it and there'd be more and more crime that you'd learn of. It may have happened a few years ago, but you'd interview more people and you'd suddenly learn about this and that. And, you know, with most cases, you know, whether it's public corruption or white collar crime, you could investigate those cases often for years and years and years. I mean, I remember telling a defense attorney of a wealthy real estate mogul that, you know, I could investigate your client for years and come up with more stuff. I'm drawing a line here. If he pleads to this, I won't keep investigating. And in fact, in that case, I ended up investigating when he wouldn't plead guilty. I investigated further and added more counts, but I could have added way more if I kept investigating. But, you know, one lesson I learned as a prosecutor is when I was a junior prosecutor, I had these cases that would go on for years because I just wanted to investigate every detail. And I learned over time that at a certain point, you have to draw a line and draw a circle around a certain amount of conduct in a certain group of people and be like, this is what I'm charging. And I know there's this other stuff out there and maybe more information will develop there, but I've got this and I'm going to charge this. And I think that's the lesson that I'm trying to get across to folks in that column. And I think that we, you know, all have to be mindful of in wanting the Congress to try to do everything at once.
And I mean, we're even seeing that right now, Bernardo. I mean, we're seeing more potential phone calls or conversations that have come up with other countries where he may have asked for favors or help, you know, and that's reporting, you know, whether that is going to be confirmed with actual transcripts like they have in the Ukraine case remains to be seen. But, you know, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that there has been some kind of pattern of behavior, even within this line of inquiry.
Yeah, I I'm glad you brought that up, Asha, because one thing that I think is important to talk about is, you know, there's been these series of phone calls and visits. I mean, Barr's been making overseas visits, essentially chasing what has been outlined by George Papadopoulos, right? Mr. Papadopoulos, in his tweets, I mean, all these conspiracy theories about Italy and Australia and all these countries that are somehow involved in an international conspiracy against Trump. And, you know, that is bizarre and wrongful for a whole slew of reasons that I think you and I should kind of tease out here on the podcast. But it's distinct from what has happened with Ukraine, because in the Ukraine example, there's no investigation in the United States. He's not using the FBI or the DOJ or Barr to do this. What's happening in the Ukraine is he, instead of going to a law enforcement agency in the United States, is having Giuliani going off to a foreign country to try to do this investigation, because there's no there. There's nothing for law enforcement even, you know, plausibly to look at. Whereas with this Barr thing, you know, there's technically this investigating the investigators. You know, I'm very, you know, very skeptical of that whole enterprise for all sorts of reasons. But it's a different type of thing. And I'm worried that, you know, Trump and Barr will try to confuse things and make the Ukraine call seem like it's part of what's going on with, you know, the trips to Italy and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. You and I talked about that. And I think that's a great thing to keep in mind. And I hope that the House committees keep that in mind as well.
But there is something very wrongful about what's going on here. I mean, I think a lot of listeners are really disturbed by what Barr is doing. And I think, you know, people like you and me who are veterans, you know, in your case of the FBI, in my case of the Justice Department, we're all very concerned and upset by what Barr is doing. I know a lot of my other former federal prosecutors who are from the Southern District of New York were very upset by the action that was taken there today. And I'm curious, you know, if you can articulate what's your take? What is your concern about what Barr has been doing?
So my concern with Barr is that it is nefarious for precisely the reason that you highlighted, that he basically has the cloak of the law enforcement authority of the United States to hide behind, to do whatever it is he's doing, which makes it harder to kind of parse out whether what he is doing is within the bounds of his authority or not. And I think that also compounding that is that he is also involved, or at least overseeing, several actions which appear to be stymieing efforts to call out the president's bad behavior. You know, he oversees the Office of Legal Counsel. He oversees the criminal division, which makes determinations on whether to pursue further investigations. So in terms of, you know, what I think he highlights is we have taken for granted, even in kind of the worst instances of presidential misconduct, whether it was, Nixon, even, Clinton, I mean, whatever, that the FBI, that the Department of Justice would be independent and would pursue any evidence of wrongdoing to its final conclusion. And I think what Barr has done is cast that into doubt. And I think once you do that, and I said this yesterday to you, Department of Justice, in my opinion, is kind of the crown jewel of our government in a way, because it has this, unprecedented independence. Once you call that into doubt, I think you just don't know, where do you go from there is my question. And how do you even begin to start to look at or figure out what is lawful and what isn't?
Yeah, I have to say, the reputation of the Justice Department and the role in which that plays, particularly in policing corrupt conduct by political figures, is important. And I will say that it exists because the Justice Department and federal prosecutors are seen, and the FBI are seen as neutral players that are not trying to, pursue some sort of, political gain or, move forward some sort of political agenda through their efforts. And if we get to a point where the FBI and DOJ are becoming used for sort of a partisan political goal, I think that we all lose from that. The United States loses. And so, one concern that I have is, I'm concerned about, having the FBI and DOJ getting drawn into so much. They're in the thick of, and they are used by Trump both as a they're a whipping boy, so to speak, for Trump. They're a target of his scorn and attack. They're used in his, advertisements and his online, efforts and fundraising efforts and so on. But also, they're now being employed by him to pursue sometimes, in many ways, it's like former heads of that of those agencies. So I guess, for me, there's a lot of people out there, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, hear from them on television or elsewhere, where they're proclaiming a lot of faith in the DOJ and FBI. I will say I have a lot of love for those institutions and for the work that they do, but I am growing concerned about whether or not those institutions are going to be used by Trump in order to do damage to our country.
That's right. These are bureaucracies, right? And so, if the very head of them is pulling them in a direction where, they are essentially acting as political extensions of the White House. I mean, you can have whistleblowers, but again, as I just highlighted, then you also have this, paradox where that very same department can, as we've seen, kind of block those whistleblowers. You would have to have kind of a mass mutiny or something to really resist that leadership, right? And I think it just is highlighting the dangers of having someone like Barr in that position. And I think it kind of gets back to the Ukraine call, Renato, because I think that right now the question is, what can Americans use as their true north? Right. Mm-hmm. In terms of orienting themselves on how to make sense of everything that's going on. And it used to be the Department of Justice is on it. That's kind of that helps me figure out that, this there may be something fishy here. We can't trust that anymore. I would say the true north now is something that is just fundamental in the Constitution and in the idea of someone taking public office, which is when you enter a position of public trust, you are using all the authority that is conferred to you by the people to further the interests of the people. You cannot use that power for a personal gain. You cannot self-deal. And so I think whenever we are looking at things that are coming up, people should ask themselves, Is this something that is in the interest of the United States? Is this something that is furthering the foreign policy of the United States that protects our national security? Or is this something that benefits Donald Trump personally? And if it's the latter, then I think something smells. And that should be the clue.
Yeah, I have to say one reason why I feel like the Ukraine episode stands separate and apart from a lot of this other stuff is that it answers that question very easily. I think everyone understands that getting dirt on Biden and his family is just benefits Trump, doesn't benefit the nation more broadly. But, you know, as to this other stuff, you know, and that's part of the, I think, the danger of it. I mean, I'm very concerned about the way, I mean, I wrote a column, I don't know, a few weeks ago about the case against Andrew McCabe, which looks very weak to me. But I am concerned because on its face, an argument can be made. Like, if you take the allegations against, you know, that Trump is making and his allies are making against Comey and McCabe and, you know, Holder and everybody else, Bruce Orr, all these people that they're talking about, if you take them seriously on their face and you don't kind of go beneath the surface, they sound like something that you should be concerned about. And it's really the bottom line is that they make a bunch of accusations that are baseless, often by distorting the facts, often by leaving out facts. And so really it's a factual issue rather than, you know, something that on its face the public can make sense of. And what's so alarming and pernicious about it is that the average person who's focused on their kid's soccer game or, you know, their fantasy football league or whatever it may be, they're going to have trouble when they hear in the news that, okay, well, the attorney general is, you know, investigating corruption at the FBI. That sounds like something that we should all be concerned about, right? That's the concern about it.
No, it's a whole Jedi mind trick that's happening. And yeah, like I said, the fact that the DOJ may be a part of it is really what makes it most problematic of all.
It is very problematic. And yet, because it's so complicated, it's the sort of thing that's why I'm like, well, I would focus on the Ukraine piece because it's so complicated, but it's very problematic. And it's something that is hard and nuanced for journalists to cover. It's the sort of thing that I think is hard for journalists to cover in a way that can really inform the public. And that's so important. And I think we could see that with what we've been calling the Schiff Show today, where the New York Times was trying to cover this, you know, what the whistleblower did and how that came, you know, how he or she came to be, you know, on the path that they were on, becoming a whistleblower, and reported something that is, I think, you know, of interest to the public, which is, okay, you know, this person, tried to raise the concerns internally when nothing happened, reached out to the House Intel Committee and was told, you know, you need to go through the official channels, whistleblower channels, whatever. And that is being distorted into something else. And I think part of the issue is the way that the New York Times framed the story, which made it easy to misconstrue. And there is something of interest there to the public, but I think that, and I don't think this was something they did intentionally. I think that by framing it the way they did, it made it seem like the whistleblower had a greater involvement with Schiff staff than was actually the case.
Yes, I think that's right. Basically, I think it was the tweet that that article was, shared under, made it sound like there was kind of a level of coordination between the whistleblower and the House Intelligence Committee, as opposed to, I think, what would be normal in a situation, and you've been in the government and so have I. I mean, you kind of, first you go through your internal processes. If you suddenly find that you are being blocked and you feel that you have a urgent national security matter, I mean, you're going to look for some other place where you're going to be like, okay, what do I do next?
Right.
Right. And, you know, it seems like if you have something that has classified information, maybe a congressional committee that deals with classified information, you say, like, look, what do I do if I have information about wrongdoing? What do I do? I've gone to my internal agency. I feel like it's not being taken seriously, or it might even be being buried. And then that person says, you need to get a lawyer. And you should go through the Inspector General. That's the best way to get this to Congress. I mean, that's effectively what happened here. And so the guy says, okay. And so he goes to the Inspector General. Now, you know, how this amounts to, you know, coordination or some kind of conspiracy, again, I don't know. One thing to note, Renato, is that under the IC whistleblower statute, let's say that the ICIG had determined that the whistleblower's complaint was not credible or not urgent. It actually outlines a procedure for that whistleblower to be able to contact Congress directly. You know, our laws contemplate that, you know, even in kind of the lowest level kind of situation, that there is a mechanism for a whistleblower to reach out to the congressional committee if they believe that this information has to go there and the channel, you know, that even if it's been deemed not credible and not urgent, presumably in that case, the Congress would say, okay, thanks for letting us know. So, I mean, there, it's not even like it is in some way inappropriate, even, you know, as a matter of law in the sense that it anticipates this kind of situation in one way or another, too, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. I will say that, you know, to me, there's no real allegation that Schiff did anything improper here. I think the most that people have or that have raised is that, well, he made a false statement on MSNBC when he said that we are not in, you know, direct contact with the whistleblower, and that turned out not to be true. And, you know, you could parse that however you want. I don't know whether he misspoke or whether he was being imprecise. I will remind everyone that it just shows you how hard it is to, you know, it's harder, you know, when you are in a position of power and authority, people take every word you say so seriously and pick it apart. You have to be very careful with your words. But I have to...
Well, and I'll add, Renato, that Mark Zaid, the whistleblower's lawyer, has, I mean, however we want to interpret it, has also said, no, we have not coordinated with, in other words, this was like the most superficial kind of request for guidance and feedback. I don't even think that there was ever any direct communication between Schiff and the whistleblower, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, there was, and it was some staffer got a phone call and then said, yeah, you should go, you know, if you have a complaint, go to through the whistleblower process. And the person's like, okay. I agree. I think there's no wrongdoing here, but you know what's happening here. The reason that this was consequential, and the reason I think it generated such a reaction from the right, is that how Trump works is, you know, and you and I've talked about this before. Is my read on Trump is that he's sort of like a jiu-jitsu artist. He's a counterpuncher. He's a guy who he wants to have an enemy, and then what he does is he waits for you to do something and attacks you and tries to make it all about you and what you've done wrong. And so he loves having these enemies that he can demonize. And he's not the first one to do this. The right did this with all sorts of people in the past, whether it's Hillary Clinton or John Kerry or others in the past. But he's I think, taking it to a new level. And the issue, the whistleblower made it very hard for him because we don't know the person's identity. It appears that they're like a CIA officer or some sort of official that everyone can imagine that person as being someone virtuous. And it's really hard for Trump to attack that person because that person's not out there and they haven't really done anything wrong. And, you know, if and when that person's identity is revealed and, you know, maybe they gave, $50 to Hillary Clinton, you know, then that can tie him or her to somebody that is a, quote, hated figure. And this was a way that, okay, now this person, oh, now we know, I think on the right, Trump's allies are saying, okay, now we know this person's tied to Schiff in some way, so this means something. And the reality is different from that, but that's what I think, you know, they've been able to make this story about.
I think that's right. I have to say, I mean, I think they're going to run with this, but again, the strength of the underlying allegation, the true north that we have is this transcript. It does not at all undermine this primary source. which is what Trump said and what he did in this phone call and clearly his motivations for doing it. I mean, and I think that's the piece that they just cannot escape. It is still unclear to me why they released this transcript. I don't know how anyone thought that this was somehow exculpatory or going to be helpful. And, you know, whatever's happening with the ship show, the real shit show is what happened in this phone call. And I think this might be a minor distraction. I think they're still going to have a hard time getting away from the bottom line.
I think so, too. And I think one thing that I will say, so, you know, a lot of listeners have asked about, you know, for example, can they keep delaying the articles of impeachment while they build up, you know, new evidence and more evidence about other things? You know, I think as I mentioned in my comments earlier, I think the impetus on the Democrats is to do the opposite, to speed to the finish line here, and not to allow the stonewalling of the Trump administration or the distractions by Trump to derail them. And so, you know, one thing that I did like seeing was Schiff just sort of being full speed ahead, even though they're, you know, Giuliani saying he won't appear, even though Pompeo is raising all these concerns. You know, litigating this stuff in the courts takes weeks, months. It could take a long time. You know, what the Democrats, I think, don't need to do now is to spend a lot of time sort of flailing and waiting for the courts to, you know, do something. They need to just sort of move forward and say, okay, well, we don't have Giuliani's testimony. We're going to try to compel his testimony, but in the meantime, we're going to call the witnesses we can. We're going to move forward as best as we can, and then just be prepared to vote. If you can't get Giuliani in there, you don't get Giuliani in there, or Pompeo, or whoever, and just move forward with what you do have.
Yeah, and they're in a powerful position because what they're basically saying is we have the best evidence. And, you know, one of the things I said on TV last night is at this point what they really have is a rebuttable presumption. Like, we have this phone call. This is what you said. And you were basically leveraging aid on this foreign country doing some dirty work for you. That is a prima facie case of abuse of power. Now, you know, if you have something that rebuts that, like, we're looking for more evidence. I mean, who knows what this will uncover? But if you don't, we've still got what we need to go forward. And by the way, we're conducting an impeachment inquiry, which is our, you know, broadest constitutional power, really, separation of powers wise, and we'll consider it obstruction. I mean, I think the House is really in the driver's seat here, given what they have. If they only had the complaint at this point, it would be a much different story, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The White House releasing this transcript, I mean, this is like for you when you were doing, you know, a mob case or a public corruption case, like you have the phone call.
Right.
You have the dude talking. And so, like, you know, it's great to bolster that with a lot of other things to make it just, you know, airtight. But you still have the basic prima facie evidence that you need.
I agree with that. And that's why, I mean, one thing that I still do not understand is why they released the transcript, and then also why they released the whistleblower complaint so quickly. In other words, you know, if the Trump administration just stonewalled, as they've done with so many other things, you know, this could have built up over a long time. There was reports.
Oh, we'd be in a black hole right now.
Right, and then he'd do something else, and, you know, people would be focused on the next thing, you know, bars in Italy, or whatever the new thing of the day is, and whatever, like, what's he doing in Italy, and, like, you know, or whatever the thing of the day is, oh, the taxes, you know, which we can talk about, you know, isn't this awful what they're doing with this?
Well, why do you think they released it? Like, what were they thinking?
I think that Trump, my best guess, and this is speculation, so I'm going to say that, is Trump keeps saying that this was a perfect call. He says this every day. So he may have just really believed that this was super perfect and wonderful and insisted that it get released. And perhaps in the past, there were people who would stop him or be a check on him, like, you know, General Kelly would be like, no, we're not doing this. And he doesn't have that person left. And you know, there has been some reporting that Mick Mulvaney, you know, that Trump and his, you know, some of the others around him are upset that Mick Mulvaney didn't have a better plan for dealing with the fallout from the transcript. And, you know, it really, my guess is that Mulvaney didn't stop Trump from doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because there's no good reason to do it. Yeah.
It was dumb.
I mean, the thing is, I will say, to give them a tip of the cap, this did work for Trump Jr. So Trump Jr., if you remember, released all those emails being like, yep, I want to, you know, I you know, if it's what you say, I love it, you know, especially in the summer.
That's true.
And it was awful, and it ended up kind of eventually, you know,
fizzling out.
And so I think maybe their thought was, let's just get the worst of it out there. I think that's why Pompeo came forward today and took the heat and said, I was on the call. And they're hoping that there'll be a distraction or they'll find some way to muddy the waters and, you know, they'll rally the Republicans and they'll move on. I think that's exactly what they're hoping at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the Don Jr. Comparison, because I wonder if part of what I mean, so much of this is about the psychology of the American public, right? And what happened in the Don Jr. case is you had first a lot of reporting about an ostensible cover-up. And, you know, was this the real reason? Like, what was really happening? Was Donald Trump involved in, you know, creating this press release or whatever? And then you get this underlying evidence, which frankly is kind of damning, in my opinion, still. But, you know, it wasn't as damning as maybe the coverage of the cover-up, like, built it up to be. And here you actually have what the release of the underlying event. And then you subsequently had reporting that then they tried to cover it up by putting it. I think that psychologically impacts people, right? Like, at first, their first impression is, holy crap, this is, like, really bad. Like, why did he freaking say that? Like, who says that on a telephone call? And then you get the double whammy of, oh, my God, and then they were trying to hide these on these, you know, code word servers. And, you know, that means it must have been really bad. Whereas, in some ways, when you reverse that that chain of revelation, you might end up with the opposite effect. I'm just kind of throwing out, like, and I think goes to the bigger issue, which is the Mueller investigation really helped Trump, because a criminal investigation keeps things under wraps, and so the public is really relying on these little drips and you know, things that are coming out and trying to put them together, whereas what's happening here is just, like, everything is being barfed out in real time. If they had a special prosecutor, like, this would not be happening right now.
Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, and certainly, and if Trump had just, during the Mueller investigation, just watched Fox News and ate some Cheetos or pizza or whatever, he'd be fine. Like, in other words, if he got himself in trouble was all the stuff for trying to fire Mueller, fire Comey. You know, if he just sort of chilled out.
If he had shut up and just gone about his life like it wasn't happening, absolutely.
Right. But as to this, I think another problem is, Asha, just, you know, is that on its face, the transcript of the call is kind of tells the whole story and is inherently problematic. So, you know, there the abuse of power is clear from the call itself. And the difference with the Don Jr. stuff is, yeah, it's really shady, it's really bad, but it, you know, the goalpost there was, did Don Jr. commit a federal crime? And was Donald Trump in on it? And I have to say, the expectations were in bizarro world from that entire investigation, where the whole way the media narrative was, is there a conspiracy between the Russian intelligence operatives and the Trump campaign? And it's like, to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what Robert Mueller was trying to look for, that's like very, very difficult. Whereas here, the issue is, is there an abuse of power? And did Donald Trump do it? And it's like, okay, we literally get the call transcript from the White House, and it says it right on its face. Well, there you go. I mean, it's just sort of there.
Yeah, I mean, this is Nixon ordering to break it. Like, I mean, it's like there's not much more to say beyond that, except that that's bad and illegal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I will say one thing that's interesting to me, though. It's so I... you know, I asked listeners for questions literally just a few hours ago. We have almost 100 questions from listeners. And if I had to say what is the biggest bucket of questions, a big bucket of questions from people are, when is Congress going to use its inherent contempt powers? When are they going to, like, toss Giuliani in prison or toss Pompeo in prison? I don't think that's – or in jail, whatever, however you want to term it. I don't think that will ever happen for all sorts of reasons that I think I've explained in the podcast before. What is your view on that, Asha? Because people want to know about that.
Yeah, so I am not an expert in Congress's contempt powers. But, okay, so we know that they're not going to use their criminal contempt powers because that would require the Department of Justice to actually enforce it, which Barr is not going to do, right?
Well, they think that, and that you can use, like back in, you know, 100 plus years ago, you know, they would send the sergeant at arms out to, like, you know, get people and put them up in the little lockup in the Capitol.
Yeah, there was some like jail in the basement, right? I actually asked somebody. I was like, "Is this that's still there?" Because I think that would have been kind of cool if they like sent somebody down to the dungeon in the basement of Congress. But apparently, that room is not there anymore. So one of the things that someone who has had experience on the Hill said, it's not really. It's unclear who would be the enforcement person, right? Is it like Sergeant at Arms like goes out and like tries to, you know, arrest, I don't know, the Secretary of State or whoever. And then where do they put them? So I think that there are just logistical problems beyond the fact that they haven't used it in over 100 years.
That's what I always come to. The logistics of it's hard. People at home, I think that my guess is that there's – so I'll make a confession. I'm not up all day watching cable news. But my suspicion is that there are some legal analysts on TV that are like, let's just lock them up. They have inherent contempt. I have seen some stuff, you know, the times I have watched cable news where some people say this.
And what I was saying, Renato, just to clarify, is my understanding is they can go to a court – and get a criminal contempt order, which would then be enforceable by, I assume, like the FBI or something. But I think
U.S. Marshals. It'll be U.S. Marshals, but yeah.
Yeah, U.S. Marshals. But like, I think that involves, you know, going to the court, and then, you know, is there a question on whether that would be enforceable? Then they do have a civil contempt authority where they can fine the person, right, like day after day, and just like make them pay money for not complying. And then inherent contempt is kind of their own like authority that is emanating from themselves as an institution. And that's what we're talking about, is that they don't really have an enforcement mechanism or a place to put people.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, it's good. You're clearly the professor of the two of us, because I think you explained that very well.
I want people to know like what the three avenues are. Yeah,
you totally explained that well. You're exactly right. So we're talking about the third option, and my point is the idea that Sergeant at Arms is going to like walk into the State Department building, you know, go through. I guess you can imagine the Sergeant at Arms. Like, how's he even going to get past security to get in there with his weapon and everything to
Does
arrest?
Does he have a weapon?
Who knows? But I assume. But I mean, you know, there are people who are probably vandalizing the Capitol or doing other things that they have to deal with. There are security concerns at the Capitol. There are Capitol police.
Right.
You know, but like
removing people who are disruptive in hearings, et cetera.
Yeah, but are they really going to be out there, like, you know, going to Giuliani's house and arresting him and putting him somewhere?
No. They're not going to do an armbar tackle on Giuliani.
Yeah, the people at home, I always get why, you know, why is that? And I'm trying to explain it as best I can, but that's not going to happen. But, you know, but I do think, to me, being serious about this is just moving forward as opposed to, you know, and just to me, going to the courts, you can go to the courts, you can do walk and chew gum at the same time. But while that's going on, just keep moving forward, keep with your investigation. You know, the reality is like, you know, it would be nice to have, you know, Giuliani in the chair taking the fifth or something, I imagine, if you're a House investigator. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, you just keep moving forward with the evidence you do have. You know, I guess another thing that I'm getting a lot of questions on, you know, is, you know, people asking, well, what, you know, sort of procedurally, what happens with this impeachment inquiry, you know, is there a chance that, you know, this never gets taken up by the Senate? And, you know, is there a chance they wait for a long time to take it up? Do you have any thoughts on that?
So, I mean, I'll give you what my sense is, right? So, you know, these committees do their investigation or their inquiries. I think that ultimately their findings get consolidated in the House Judiciary Committee, which is where any articles of impeachment would come out of. And I don't know all the procedural things that require, you know, actually formally presenting and voting on articles of impeachment, but articles of impeachment are effectively the analog of a grand jury indictment. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
It's a charge. It's an accusation. Yeah. It's basically the House saying, we have now finished our investigation, and we believe that there is probable cause to believe that the president has committed these, you know, offenses. And Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, blah, blah, blah. We vote on it. These are the ones that we are essentially, quote, unquote, charging him with. I don't think that there is necessarily any discretion for the Senate to not take it up for a trial at that point. I think even Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he would have to. But my understanding is that they then can come up with whatever rules they want for that, right? So there's no playbook for how that trial can go. I mean, I assume that they could effectively do the equivalent of a motion to dismiss on the very first day if they want to, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, there is precedent out there in prior impeachment trials, not only of presidents, but also of judges and people like that. And, you know, there's a very good book that Lawrence Tribe wrote about impeachment. He was a prior guest. And, you know, I spent time reading about all of these prior impeachment trials in that book. And, you know, there are precedents, but, you know, to be just very blunt here, you know, I don't really think that the presentation of evidence and arguments in the course of that impeachment trial is going to be some sort of game changer. In other words, you know, we've all lived through, you and I, Ash, I believe we're in law school. We were both in law school together when Bill Clinton's impeachment trial happened. And there was a very long report, and everyone read that Starr report and had opinions about what was happening. And it's not like Lindsey Graham's arguments in front of the Senate or the evidence that he and his fellow House managers were putting on really moved the needle. I imagine it could be amongst the Senate. Well, you know, we're not senators. We don't know. But it seems to me that the more important thing is, you know, being able to make the case to the American people about what that's about and why this is serious. Here, I don't think there's any question of did he do it? Although maybe in his own mind, I don't know.
I think that's right. And I mean, what I have said continuously is the only variable that we really have here. And we can take a snapshot right now and say, you know, nothing's going to move the needle in terms of the Senate, you know, voting to convict, except that we are dealing with Donald Trump. And I mean, he's kind of losing it day by day, right? Like as this goes forward, I mean, I think we need to understand that the narcissistic injury that even the process of going into an impeachment inquiry causes him. I mean, think about what you said, Renato, earlier, that people are now at a point where they just are not saying no to him in the White House, because he just loses his mind, right? That you can't really counter him. And now he's in a situation where he cannot control it. He doesn't know who the whistleblower is. He can't stop Nancy Pelosi. This thing is happening that's going to say that he's not the best president in the history of the world, which is what he believes he is. I think this could really trigger, and we've seen evidence of this, like a serious, serious meltdown on his part. And I don't think we can underestimate whether that itself could change the needle in terms of, you know, I have to believe that there is some point where even Senate Republicans say, we can't have a madman on, like, I mean, this guy is like completely going like just bonkers to the point where his approval ratings are going down or whatever. It's better for us to have like just a sane individual on the ticket, right? That could be a long shot, but I'm not discounting it as a possibility is all I'm saying.
That's fair. I don't know what's going to happen either. I'm not going to discount any possibility. People often ask me, okay, what's going to happen? And I get that all the time. I mean, I remember getting that question 2 years ago. I was on MSNBC at the time. Lawrence O'Donnell's asking me, so like, well, what's going to happen in the Senate? And it's like, I was like, I'm not an expert on what's going on in the minds of Republican senators. And so who knows what's going to happen and how this could turn out. I will say that, you know, we don't know, and we don't know, Trump could just continue to make things worse. But, you know, certainly if the last playbook is, you know, from the last few years has taught us anything, it's that you shouldn't underestimate the loyalty of Republican senators to Donald Trump.
Yeah. So I actually saw a question in the questions on Twitter. And I think I know the answer, but then I was like, well, maybe I don't. And it said, can senators vote by secret ballot for
a conviction? Oh, that was a good one.
And I was like, at first I was like, no, of course, they have to be on the record. But then I thought, well, they're making up their own rules. And if they're effectively acting as a jury, I mean, you don't know how a juror votes individually, do you? Like,
yeah, I get your point. Although the Senate rules, I think, call for the votes to be public. Certainly they were in the Clinton impeachment trial. And, you know,
But for legislation, right? I mean, like, do they have any latitude in terms of what they can do in a trial? Or do those same rules apply even when they are voting on conviction or acquittal for purposes of impeachment?
Well, the Senate can do whatever it wants. They have total latitude. If Mitch McConnell decided and got, you know, 51 votes, decided they wanted to change the rules, they could, okay? There's no question about that. We've seen it happen in our lifetimes. But I will say, as to the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the votes are on the record. You can go and look on Google and find out how each senator voted one way or the other on the Clinton impeachment. So I would expect, I'm not an expert on Senate rules, but I would be surprised if it wouldn't be on the record here. And unless McConnell wants it to go the other way, in other words, unless the Republicans get together and say, look, none of us want to take the fall for this, but we're going to...
But he's crazy cakes, and we just need to, like, do this.
Yeah, so let's do it a secret and then have exactly 20 votes, and then we'll all say that we're part of the 33. I mean, they could try that, but you could imagine the fire and ire that would come from the Republican base because, you know, Trump has built up, and he's not the only one. Ted Cruz and others have, you know, attacked the Beltway Republicans, and the reason that, you know, McConnell...
Oh, my God, Ted Cruz would be the first person in the secret ballot to vote against, to vote to convict Trump. Come on. That's the thing. That's the crazy part, is that some of these, I bet Lindsey Graham, too. I mean, you know what I mean? If they just had the cover.
But you know that Ted Cruz, before him and Trump ran for president, he was attacking his own, the reason they all hate him there. Remember when Lindsey Graham said that if Ted Cruz was, you know, on the floor of the Senate, people were, it was like sort of like, if there was, oh yeah, if Ted Cruz was murdered on the floor of the Senate, there would be no witnesses or something like that.
That's awful.
It was awful, but it was essentially like, essentially
that's
the point
how much
was
people hate him.
Yeah, hate him because he would attack his fellow Senate Republicans and basically tell people at home that they, you know, the deals that they were doing essentially just to keep the government open and stuff were like selling them out sort of thing. So could you imagine the conspiracy theories amongst the Republican base if all of the Beltway Republicans, right, got together and had a secret ballot to remove Trump? It would be like a conspiracy.
I think it would be awesome.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like this is more of a pipe dream than anything. So I will say, to move from pipe dream to something, I'll get another listener question that I think is really important and useful, is that your listener question asked, you know, does the same OLC opinion apply to the vice president? Okay, and I think that's an interesting question.
That's a great question.
Yeah, a super question. And the answer, I believe, is no. Do you agree with that? Because this is a multi-parter from this listener.
Okay. So I would also, my gut would say no. And my reasoning, and I'd be interested to compare with yours, is that the OLC opinion is essentially based on the duties of the president and essentially the distraction and the time that it would take for a president to be able to effectively mount a defense. You know, against an indictment. And basically the vice president doesn't do anything to begin with.
Exactly right. The vice president has no role at all. I think there's some joke that John Adams told about that or somebody, you know, back around the founding that essentially the vice president had essentially no role. So, yeah, I think that OLC opinion doesn't hold up when applied to the vice president. So I agree. We're on the same page there. I will say, though, you know, and just before I move on to the rest of this listener's question, that, you know, one thing that I thought was fascinating about DOJ's move to try to intervene in the Trump, tax return thing is there's no indictment of Trump. There's no imminent indictment or anything of that nature. What's happening there is they're conducting an investigation, and the ostensible reason why the DOJ is getting involved in a lawsuit brought by a private citizen who's trying to block his tax returns, you know, from being obtained by a state authority. And by the way, this is a third party subpoena. In other words, the state prosecutor here, you know, is obtaining subpoenas from the accounting firms, and he says he has an interest in that, and so he's bringing a suit. And so why is the federal government interest? Well, they said that there's these important, you know, quote, federalism concerns. And when you read the brief, it's all about essentially the OLC opinion. They cite to the OLC opinion and they talk about the distractions that it would cause the president and yada, yada. And so it seems to me like they want to go beyond the original OLC opinion, which said you can investigate the president, you just can't indict him, which Mueller not only discusses in writing in the Mueller report, but testified about. And they're trying to expand that. You can't investigate the president.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right, because the rationale that we just talked about, that, you know, that announcing a defense, which, you know, you have a Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment right to do, you know, if you actually are charged, to confront your accusers, to have due process, all these things take time, right? If you're going to really exercise those rights to the fullest, those don't apply in the investigative phase. In the investigative phase, you're just in the dark while somebody else is, like, investigating you. And it's kind of what gets to what we said before, that actually in the Mueller investigation, if Trump had just kept his mouth shut and, you know, gone golfing and eaten Doritos, I mean, he would have been fine, probably. The president himself is not an active participant in the investigative phase. I mean, he might be nervous or anxious, but that in and of itself does not distract, you know, practically speaking, from the duties. And actually, I believe, and I have to double check this, but I believe that now Justice Kavanaugh wrote a law review article that kind of confirmed this idea of the bifurcation of the investigative and, you know, indictment trial phases of the criminal procedure, and seemed to kind of go along with the OLC idea that, you know, you can still investigate. And I think the Mueller report also bolsters the idea of why you would want to investigate if there is grounds to do so, which is, and Mueller says this in the report, even though we knew we couldn't indict him, we believed it was important to investigate while memories were still fresh, while evidence was still available. And you can imagine that if, you know, Trump has done some wrongdoing, let's say he gets elected for another term, like, are investigators supposed to wait 6 years to take any investigative steps at all? You know, what are the retention policies for these companies? I mean, if you can't even, like, issue things like preservation orders or subpoenas, you are effectively stymieing this process. And then the third whammy is that you are also here talking about a state. And so you have federalism concerns, but I think they also cut in favor of a state, which has its own sovereign interests to vindicate. This is the whole idea behind the dual sovereignty doctrine and why states can also prosecute the same conduct as the federal government, right? And so people who kind of talk about states' rights, one would think, would want the state to be able to, even if they can't indict the president, be able to investigate so that at some point they can act on the fruits of that investigation.
For sure. And you all, I mean, and there, and it may be immediately. In other words, sometimes an investigation can result in other people other than the president who could be charged immediately. So,
yeah,
you know, the mere fact that the president's tax returns or anything else might be relevant to a criminal investigation doesn't necessarily mean that he would be the one who's charged. For all we know, an accountant or a CFO or somebody else might be charged.
Absolutely. So, yeah, because they are looking at the Trump organization, which, I mean, not for nothing, but I think that there could be some a lot of shady stuff involved in that.
Who knows? So that's exactly the point. So, I mean, I think on its face, it seems to me very problematic, a very kind of a weak argument on their part. And it's also procedurally kind of a stretch. And that's really the focus, of course, of what their brief was now.
But why? I mean, how exactly, I think this gets to the bigger question of how exactly does the Justice Department take it upon itself via the Southern District to even intervene in this private suit? Like,
I should have probably done an explainer on this or something today, but I spent a little bit of time reading that brief today, which was interesting. And essentially, their argument is, to a very high level, just to boil it down, is that the interests of the United States are implicated in this private suit between a citizen and a state prosecutor, because the office of the president has this unique role, and the OLC opinion talks about how the president can't be distracted and so on and so forth.
And these were the same issues that were raised in the Clinton administration with a civil suit.
Correct. And the Supreme Court said
same arguments, right?
Yeah.
And the OLC and the Department of Justice intervened on Clinton's behalf and they rejected it. And that was a state court civil action.
That's right. Now, of course, we have a different Supreme Court today. I mean, that was 2000, right, or so, something like that, or whatever it was.
So one of the justices was one of the prosecutors on the case.
Indeed. So it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see what happens here. But I will say, just the whole posture is unusual. I could see I could just see a judge rejecting this whole effort and just saying, this isn't the United States business. That's one way of going about this, just denying their ability to intervene. And then it'll be interesting to see what they do next. But I will say too, everyone's talking about this as the Southern District of New York. It is in fact the case that the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York has his name on this. So does the Chief of the Civil Division. But all the attorneys who actually worked on it, and it's very clear on the signature line,
It's
from Maine Justice.
So it's really, okay, that's helpful to know.
Yeah, so it's essentially just Maine Justice putting the name of the Southern District on there for whatever reason. They thought maybe it would be helpful, I suppose. Maybe it would blunt the criticism that this was coming from Barr or for perception.
Because I was going to say, they don't have to, right? Maine Justice can bring something on its own.
I tried a case against Maine Justice in Chicago earlier this year, in which Maine Justice brought an indictment and so forth, without the involvement whatsoever with the U.S. Attorney's Office here.
Interesting.
So that happens on a regular basis. In any event, regarding Pence, we got a lot of questions about Pence, and I will just say, a lot of people, I think, are asking these questions because they're thinking in their head, okay, could Pence be implicated and both Trump and Pence get impeached and removed? And what I just want to say to answer all of these questions in one fell swoop is, remember what happened with Nixon. In other words, Nixon's vice president got in trouble, Spiro Agnew. The ticket was Nixon-Agnew. Agnew resigned, replaced with Gerald Ford, who no one elected to anything. He was the minority leader in the Senate at the time, right? He was the equivalent of Mitch McConnell sort of figure. He was put in as vice president. Then Nixon resigned later, and then Ford was elevated to the presidency, and he pardoned Nixon. And I guess what I would just say is,
are you telling me that Mitch McConnell might end up as president?
Well, who knows who
Please.
It would be?
I already have him having nightmares.
It could be. Even if this situation, and we have no reason at this point, I don't think, to believe that that Pence would be removed from office. But even in that circumstance, you could imagine that it would be President Nikki Haley or somebody else, right? President, whoever it might be, who would end up pardoning whoever, Trump or Pence. And, so you cannot expect here that you're ever going to end up with President Pelosi, which is, I think, what all these questions are getting at.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I think for a future podcast, it's worth kind of talking about. And I was at the Texas Tribune Festival with a lot of your former prosecutor colleagues and another former FBI colleague, you know, this idea that people really are attached to Trump and maybe Pence and Barr or whoever, you know, getting rounded up and put in orange jumpsuits and ending up in prison. And, you know, I don't know that that's a realistic outcome, and I don't know that even if push comes to shove, that's the best outcome in terms of, you know, we may get to a point where Trump decides to resign under some certain conditions that may preclude that. And, you know, it's worth kind of exploring those possibilities because I think people really are attached to the idea that everybody's going to go to jail.
I mean, one thing that I think has happened is there's been a lot of, and I think partly it's many of our fellow legal analysts, some of the folks you're with in Texas, I think we've given people the impression sometimes that the legal system is just going to work this all out and like everyone's going to go to jail. I think that that is overblown by a very large stretch. And, you know, really we're people should hopefully have gotten some sense from this by now that these problems are beyond what the criminal justice system is typically dealing with. And yeah. I am very skeptical of the idea that for this type of thing that Trump will end up in jail. Now, I do think it's possible for example, the Mueller type obstruction. You know, I could see partly because of the public sentiment that's out there, a future Democratic president being in a spot where they have to at least, you know, not get in the way of the Justice Department doing something with this. But, you know, who knows what will ever come of that. If I was a betting person, I would not bet on those orange jumpsuits.
I would not bet on the orange jumpsuits either.
Well, on that not optimistic potentially for many of our listeners.
By the way, I just want to clarify. And this is where I was getting at. I don't think no orange jumpsuit means that, you know, that Trump there's no other option for him to leave. That's the point. Is that right. Not the only way that he gets removed from office or the ultimate outcome that could come of this whole thing.
I think, look, I'm not an expert on the brains of politicians, but they all seem to be very self-interested, calculating type people.
Yep.
And I think whenever there gets to a point where they see that the future benefits of being associated and supporting Donald Trump are outweighed by the downside, they're going to just flip whenever that happens. And the reason it hasn't happened so far is because the base, Republican base, is so excited about Donald Trump that all of these people would be primaried, like Lindsey Graham and so on, if they change course. What it would take is just, Trump's being discredited to such an extent that the Republicans decide, you know, it's not worth defending this guy.
Exactly.
Let's move on and restore our brand.
Exactly.
On that maybe more positive note, it has been a real pleasure, Asha. Thank you for joining me and for hashing this out for all of our listeners. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always great hashing this out with you. I always feel more clarity in my own thinking after we talk. So
I feel the same way. Thanks, Asha. Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.